Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 279. It's Monday, October 21st. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's get up to it with some, I think, with some good news. This is from Medical Express. Countries that choose to do so can reduce premature death by half, researchers say. Since 1970, 37 countries have cut the probability of their citizens dying before they reach age 70 in half, a milestone that signals the remarkable progress many countries have made in preventing and treating disease. But a new report argues that this goal isn't out of reach for any country that chooses to cut its premature mortality, even those afflicted by war or poverty. The report, published by the Lancet Commission on Investing in Health, lays out a roadmap for every nation that chooses to do so to cut the chance of premature death for its citizens in half by 2050. The goal, which the commission calls 50 by 50, is achievable, argues the report, through a series of targeted health investments, such as expanding childhood immunizations and low-cost prevention and treatments for common causes of preventable death, combined with scaling up financing to develop new health technologies. Today, the case is better than ever for going for mortality reduction, says Gavin Yammey, director of the Duke University Center for Policy Impact and Global Health, who led the writing of the commission report. It's a prize within reach. It will have extraordinary health, welfare, and economic benefits. Reaching 50 by 50 would reduce mortality and morbidity, help grow economies, and alleviate poverties. The Global Health 2050 report, which was launched at the World Health Summit in Berlin, argues that countries should prioritize the 15 health conditions that cause most premature deaths. These include infectious diseases such as tuberculosis and respiratory infections, non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and other issues such as injuries and suicide. Most of the gains in global life expectancy over the past two decades are attributable to reductions in mortality from these conditions, according to the report. However, millions of people around the world still lack access to prevention and treatment services that could protect them from these causes of premature death. The authors say countries can make significant gains by publicly subsidizing the cost of essential medicines, diagnostics, vaccines, and other interventions that address these 15 conditions. This public subsidy, they argue, should be combined with scaled-up financing of research and innovation to develop new health technologies. If the 50 by 50 goals are reached by every country, a person born in 2050 would have only a 15% chance of dying before age 70, down from 31% for someone born in 2019. Among the 37 countries that are on track to reach the benchmark are seven of the world's most populous nations, including Bangladesh, China, and Iran. But such gains are achievable and sustainable across any high, middle, and low-income country that chooses this path, the report asserts. The authors lay out specific policies and health financing strategies that make it feasible for even the poorest countries to take a cost-effective approach to reducing mortality. Health policy changes people's lives, said Wanhao Mao, a senior policy analyst at Duke University and one of the 50 authors on the commission report. Without good health policies, populations won't get the health outcomes they deserve. Large disparities will continue to occur. The report calls for increased taxation on tobacco products, unhealthy foods and drinks, and fossil fuels, which the authors say would both reduce illness and death attributable to those products and raise revenue that can be reinvested in health systems. While all these taxes are win-win, the commissioner's clear message is that by far the highest priority is high taxes on tobacco. The commission points out, for example, that smoking remains one of the biggest causes of preventable mortality in many parts of the world, causing more than 8 million deaths worldwide annually, according to the World Health Organization. Raising taxes on tobacco may be the single most important health policy in the commission's report, Yammy notes, because of the immediate gains it could create for the world's poorest citizens. They are the most price sensitive, so they're more likely to quit when tobacco prices rise, he says. Therefore, they are more likely to get the health and financial benefits of giving up smoking. Early mortality and early death from diseases is awful for families, communities, economies, and countries. You want people living long, healthy, productive lives. We hope this report helps bring focus on this global health agenda. Now, that's very optimistic. It certainly shows, the fact that we have learned in recent decades, generations, how exactly to do this. It's just a question of political will and putting resources, investments into that. My only really skepticism about this is I'd like to have seen more about what the potential things interfering with this. Because we live in a different world than we did, 50 years ago. And so the 50 by 50 goals are actually solidified by the world's experience 50 years ago. But I think we have a lot of new challenges that could, unfortunately, possibly short-circuit some of this. I would think climate change is by far the most likely and substantial in size to threaten these gains. But hey, we have learned a lot, and we can do far, far more in taking those lessons learned to getting health benefits for people across the globe in every country. Okay, well, focusing back on the United States and one particular important health metric or health behavior, this from Medical Express. New U.S. report card on physical activity for children and youth reveals continued low levels of physical activity. The Physical Activity Alliance, the nation's largest national coalition dedicated to advancing regular participation in physical activity, released the 2024 United States report card on physical activity for children and youth. The overall physical activity grade for children and youth remained low at D-, the same grade it received in 2022, the last time a report was made. The grade was derived from the National Survey of Children's Health and the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data that showed that only 20 to 28% of 6 to 17-year-olds meet the 60 minutes of daily physical activity recommended by the U.S. Physical Activity Guidelines for America. Also, the proportion of children who meet the physical activity guidelines has decreased slightly since 2016, when these data were first available. According to the CDC, as of 2021, more than 40% of school-aged children and adolescents had at least one chronic health condition, such as asthma or obesity. In 2022, a report published in JAMA Pediatrics found that nearly 1 in 3 adolescents now meet the criteria for prediabetes, and the rate among 12 to 19-year-olds had more than doubled, from 11% to 28% between 1999 and 2018. We need to re-engineer our environments and routines to build activity back in. This means providing more opportunities for children to be active that are safe and enjoyable. Policymakers and other community leaders can support children's health by carefully considering the important role all sectors of society play in removing barriers to physical activity. So the United States is in good company, as most places across the globe are actually becoming more sedentary. Fighting an uphill battle with that. So walk up a hill, my friends. Okay, well, let's turn to a big success for youth in this country. This from Medical Express. Teen smoking and other tobacco use dropped to lowest levels in 25 years, CDC reports. Teen smoking hit an all-time low in the U.S. this year, part of a big drop in the youth use of tobacco overall. The government reported. There was a 20% drop in the estimated number of middle and high school students who recently used at least one tobacco product, including cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, nicotine pouches, and hookahs. The number went from 2.8 million last year to 2.25 million this year, the lowest since the CDC's key survey began in 1999. Reaching a 25-year low for youth tobacco product use is an extraordinary milestone for public health, said Deidre Lawrence Kittner, director of CDC's Office on Smoking and Health. However, our mission is far from complete. A previously reported drop in vaping largely explains the overall decline in tobacco use from 10% to about 8% of students, health officials said. The youth e-cigarette rate fell to under 6% this year, down from 7.7% last year, the lowest of any point in the last decade. E-cigarettes are the most commonly used tobacco products among teens, followed by nicotine pouches. Officials attribute the declines to a number of measures, ranging from price increases and public health education campaigns to age restrictions and more aggressive enforcement against retailers and manufacturers selling products to kids. Woohoo! Way to go, public health! Our kids are that much safer and healthier. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to the air that we all breathe. This from Science Daily. U.S. Air Pollution Monitoring Network has gaps in coverage, says researchers. The lack of air quality monitoring capabilities across the U.S. affects the health of millions of people and disproportionately impacts minority and low socioeconomic status communities, says researchers. Motivated by a new U.S. EPA standard for air pollution, the team employed a model for fine-scale air pollution mapping using real-world data, and it indicates there is an urgent need to address gaps in the agency's monitoring network. About 44% of highly populated metro areas in the U.S., which affect about 20 million people, have inadequate monitoring networks to comply with new EPA air quality standards. These PM 2.5 hotspots, that's particulate matter under 2.5 micrograms, these hotspots identified with monitoring data and predicted by the model have significantly higher percentages of people of color and people with low socioeconomic status compared to the overall population. Around 2.8 million people live in PM 2.5 hotspots that are not captured by the air monitoring network. Fortunately, even adding 10 monitors in the right places could make a big difference in correctly identifying which cities are breathing unhealthy air. So putting in just 10 monitors in the most critical places would provide a 60% reduction in the gap that they measured in this study. Yep, a lot of opportunity there. Our network of about 1,000 official regulatory air monitors is generally not well suited for capturing exposure disparities in every city in the country. There are just too few monitors to capture every hotspot. The team identified metro locations to add new air pollution monitors across the U.S. that could help identify large populations that currently breathe air more polluted than the EPA's new standards. The metro areas are in Texas, Ohio, California, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Missouri, and Idaho. And I looked into the details of Ohio, which has ranks last in air quality in the of U.S. states. Fortunately, it wasn't Toledo area that was the worst, but it looked like the Cleveland area and Cincinnati, the ones that had the biggest gaps in air pollution monitoring, which doesn't necessarily mean the air pollution is better or worse. It just means we're not monitoring as well and could gain from improving the monitoring network. Okay, well, next up we have a story that seemed to run a couple times a year, basically in the spring and the fall with daylight savings. This from Medical Express. Sleep advocates advocate for permanent standard time ahead of fall time change. As the country prepares to fall back to standard time on Sunday, November 3rd, the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time is advocating for the abolition of daylight saving time in favor of permanent year-round standard time, which would improve public health, safety, and overall well-being. We know from decades of research that seasonal time changes are disruptive to our health, said Dr. Karen Johnson, sleep medicine physician and co-chair of the Coalition Steering Committee. The shift to daylight savings time in the spring has been linked to an increase in motor vehicle injuries, cardiovascular events, and medical errors in the days following the change. There is widespread support for ending the biannual time changes. In fact, several states have passed legislation to eliminate seasonal time changes contingent on federal approval. Additionally, a recent survey from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine reveals that 64% of U.S. adults support eliminating seasonal time changes. There's tremendous support for eliminating time changes, but it's important to understand that making daylight savings permanent would be a big mistake, added Johnson. Our internal body clocks are synchronized with the natural timing cues provided by sunlight and darkness, so we never adjust to the artificial clock change caused by daylight savings time. Permanent daylight savings time would cause year-round problems for our sleep, alertness, mood, and health. Restoring permanent standard time would keep the clock closely aligned with the position of the sun. This alignment would support the human circadian rhythm, the internal body clock that regulates the timing of alertness, sleepiness, and many other biological functions. Standard time enables us to enjoy more sunlight in the morning when we need to rise and start the day, and it aligns darkness with the evening hours when we need to unwind and prepare to sleep. The dark side of permanent daylight savings time is that it would cause us to experience darkness later in the morning, especially during the shorter days of winter. In some parts of the U.S., sunrise wouldn't occur until after 9 a.m. in the winter, putting children at risk as they wait for the bus or walk to school in the dark. Congress enacted permanent daylight savings time in 1974, but repealed it after just winter due to public backlash. The Coalition for Permanent Standard Time is urging Congress to avoid repeating the same mistake and to make the right choice by restoring permanent standard time. Restoring permanent standard time would provide long-term health and safety benefits. Observing standard time year-round would help all of us sleep and feel better during every season. While the fall time change is often easier to manage in the spring transition, the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time encourages individuals to take steps to minimize any negative effects. This includes getting at least 7 hours of sleep per night before and after the time change. Maintaining a consistent sleep routine is critical. Adjust the time of daily routines that are time cues for your body, such as meal times or exercise schedules, by shifting them a little later in the day leading up to the time change. Set clocks back 1 hour in the early evening on Saturday, November 2nd, and then go to bed when you feel sleepy. Head outdoors for early morning sunlight during the week after the time change, as the bright light will help set your internal clock to the new time. This alignment helps regulate sleep and alertness. So this is just a good example of human beings think they can outsmart nature. And of course, there are some business reasons. People consume more when it's lighter in the evening. So you can make some arguments, I suppose, for commerce, although I don't know if in the long run that would change much. But definitely for health, the syncing of our bodies with the actual movements of the sun, rather than trying to artificially modify them and get out of sync with sun and darkness cycles, could definitely have improvements. So we'll see. It's been something that Congress debates every year but hasn't taken action for many, many years. Okay, well, next up I have a story on the quick treatment of drug overdoses. This is from WOSU.org. Ohio State study finds more bystanders are using naloxone to help people who overdose. An Ohio State University study found bystanders are using naloxone in higher quantities to help save people from overdosing on opioids. The study looked at national use of naloxone by people without medical training to treat an opioid drug overdose. The drug helps reverse the impacts of an overdose to prevent deaths. The study found the drug is being administered more by bystanders, but the vast majority of naloxone is being given by professionals when someone is overdosing. Naloxone is a life-saving medication that can reverse opioid overdose effects when given immediately, said Ashish Panchal, an Ohio State professor and the study's senior author. Similar to CPR, stepping up to help before emergency crews arrive can be the difference between life and death. The study said that more than 744,000 patients had a dose of naloxone between 2020 and 2022. Almost 25,000 of that 744,000 received naloxone from an untrained bystander. That's a 43% increase in those given by untrained bystanders. However, the study found that it still only makes up less than 4% of the total administered naloxone doses. That is according to data from 2 years from the National Emergency Medical Services Information System, the National Emergency Medical Services Patient Care Record Database. This is despite a large increase in public awareness campaigns and improved access to naloxone. Last year, the FDA approved naloxone for over-the-counter use. 46 states and D.C. provide legal immunity to bystanders who help people experiencing an opioid overdose. Unfortunately, the study found there is more work to be done since only 3.4% of EMS activations involving naloxone received it from non-medical bystanders. In a perfect world, this should be closer to 100%, highlighting a need to improve naloxone education, enhance access, and investigate and remove obstacles to its use. Amen to that. Okay, next up I have a story on ADHD in adults. This is from Science Daily. Survey finds 25% of adults suspect they have undiagnosed ADHD. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, known as ADHD, is typically thought of as a childhood condition. But more adults are realizing that their struggles with attention, focus, and restlessness could in fact be undiagnosed ADHD, thanks in large part to trending social media videos racking up millions of views. A new national survey of 1,000 American adults commissioned by the Ohio State University College of Medicine finds that 25% of adults now suspect that they have undiagnosed ADHD. But what worries mental health experts is that only 13% of survey respondents have shared their suspicion with their doctor. That's raising concerns about the consequences of self-diagnosis leading to incorrect treatment. Anxiety, depression, and ADHD, all these things can look a lot alike, but the wrong treatment can make things worse instead of helping that person feel better and improving their function, said psychologist Justine Bartarian, a clinical assistant professor in Ohio State's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health. An estimated 4.4% of people ages 18 to 44 have ADHD, and some people aren't diagnosed until they're older, Bartarian says. There's definitely more awareness of how it could contribute to continue to affect folks into adulthood, and a lot of people who are realizing, once their kids have been diagnosed, that they fit these symptoms as well, given that it's a genetic disorder, Bartarian said. The survey found that younger adults are more likely to believe they have undiagnosed ADHD than older generations, and they're also more likely to do something about it. Bartarian said that should include seeing a medical professional, usually the primary care provider, to receive a referral to a mental health expert to be thoroughly evaluated, accurately diagnosed, and effectively treated. So, if you're concerned, beware of self-diagnosis and get an appropriate diagnosis, which can lead to better care. Okay, next up, a story on glaucoma, this from Medical Express. Black adults disproportionately affected as glaucoma reaches 4.22 million in the U.S. Glaucoma is the leading cause of irreversible blindness worldwide that disproportionately affects ethnic minority groups in the United States. Current prevalence of the disease has remained largely unknown as no national estimates have been made in over a decade. Results show that over 4 million U.S. adults were living with glaucoma in 2022, with a prevalence of 1.6% among those age 18 and older. When narrowing the pool to 40 and older, the prevalence increased to 2.6%, which is about 1 in 40 for those over the age 40. Among the over 4 million, 1.5 million were living with vision-affecting glaucoma, representing over 0.5% of the U.S. adult population. Demographic disparities were clear, with black adults experiencing the highest glaucoma prevalence at over 3% compared to under 1.5% among white adults, over double the rate. Okay, well, it's Medicare enrollment season, and Medicare Advantage plans, or what I call Medicare disadvantage plans, are in the news again. This from MedPage Today. Use of prior authorization up in Medicare Advantage plans, Senate report finds. Medicare Advantage plans have increased their use of prior authorization and appear to be targeting certain types of care, such as expensive post-acute hospital care, for coverage denials, according to a report issued by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Insurers are using prior authorization to protect billions in profits while forcing vulnerable patients into impossible choices, the subcommittee's report concluded. This is particularly troubling when recent analyses indicate that Medicare Advantage is more expensive than traditional Medicare, the report continued. There is a role for the free market to improve the delivery of healthcare to American seniors, but there is nothing inevitable about the harms done by the current arrangement. Insurers can and must do better for the sake of the American healthcare system and the patients the government entrusts to them. I think it's kind of interesting that a Senate committee is just asking insurers that they could do better. They're the ones who can pass the laws they need to rein in Medicare Advantage. You can't expect these hugely profitable healthcare plans to lower their profits just because you ask them to. So much for the free market. The free market, as it turns out, can be quite expensive for most of us.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see, try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted. Or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Now, next up, we have a story which I think is a little bit bizarre if you want to put it under the category of green energy. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Tech giants turn to nuclear power to meet growing AI energy demands. Amazon, Google, and Microsoft are investing heavily in nuclear energy to meet the massive power demands of AI and data centers while aiming for zero emissions. Microsoft, Google, and Amazon are striking deals to power AI and data centers with nuclear energy due to its reliability and lack of emissions. Small modular reactors, though unproven, are attracting investment as a potentially cheaper, scalable alternative to traditional nuclear plants. Critics warn that cost overruns, delays, and unresolved waste storage issues continue to challenge nuclear energy projects. Why this matters? AI and data centers demand increasing amounts of energy, and nuclear power offers a low-emission, reliable alternative. However, persistent concerns about cost and nuclear waste management remain key hurdles. And also, part of the way, when you say low emissions, that's not the only environmental impact. And the fact is, every gram of high-level nuclear waste that has been produced since the beginning of the nuclear industry does not have a permanent storage place. The storage has never been solved. So that's like a slight problem. And of course, carbon pollution lasts for centuries, two or three centuries, which seems like a long time. But compared to pollution for high-level nuclear waste, you're talking about tens and tens of thousands of years. If you think a couple centuries is unimaginable, try tens of millennia. Yeah, why don't we just take out a 50,000-year mortgage on humanity? Of course, fossil fuels continues to be the most pressing, with CO2 and methane pollution being the largest drivers of global climate change. Here's a fascinating and frightening story from the Environmental Health Network. Finland faces an uncertain future as its forests struggle to absorb carbon. Finland's plan for carbon neutrality by 2035 is in jeopardy, as its once reliable forests have begun emitting more carbon than they store, raising concerns for global climate targets. Finland's boreal forests, which once absorbed large amounts of carbon, are now releasing more greenhouse gases due to deforestation, rising temperatures, and forest degradation. The land sector's collapse as a carbon sink threatens Finland's ambitious climate goals, despite emission cuts in other sectors. Many countries, including Finland, now face challenges as natural carbon sinks decline, complicating efforts to meet global climate commitments. The key quote here in this story, "We cannot achieve carbon neutrality if the land sector is a source of emissions." Oh, man. Why this matters? The implications are stark. If forests stop absorbing carbon, we lose one of our most crucial defenses against climate change. Finland is a cautionary tale for the rest of the world, a reminder that natural systems we rely on are fragile, and without urgent action, the planet's ability to store carbon could collapse. So Finland isn't an isolated incident. In this particular case, it's the northern temperate countries, such as Canada, for instance, that are facing disproportionate degradation of forests. And these are also parts of the world that often have some of the largest forests and carbon reserves. So could be big trouble. And in more climate change news, this from the Environmental Health Network, countries fall behind on biodiversity goals despite upcoming UN conference. Nearly 2 years after committing to protect 30% of the planet's land and oceans by 2030, most nations have made little progress, raising concerns ahead of the upcoming United Nations Biodiversity Conference. Only 46 countries have submitted biodiversity goals, and less than 15% have even provided plans to meet them. Developing countries are waiting for $20 billion in funding, with only 77% of the goals secured so far. Conservation groups worry about vague targets, especially around species extinction and biodiversity funding. Why this matters? Without sufficient progress, global biodiversity loss threatens ecosystems essential to human survival, like water and food sources. Those are kind of nice. The lack of funding and specific plans risk undermining urgent environmental goals. This is an existential issue, my friends. Let's deal with it. And to kind of drive home how climate change is driving other issues in the world, this story from Reuters, Cows dead from bird flu rot in California as heat bakes dairy farms. Cows in California are dying at much higher rates from bird flu than other affected states, industry and veterinary experts said. And some carcasses have been left rotting in the sun as rendering plants struggle to process all the dead animals. Carcasses left in the open and picked over by scavengers could facilitate the spread of bird flu to other birds and wild animals, or degrade the carcasses such they cannot be processed for rendering, experts told Reuters. Bird flu has spread to more than 300 dairy herds in 14 states this year and infected 120 herds in top milk-producing state California since the end of August. The virus has also been known to infect 25 people this year, including 11 in California. And of course, the number of dairy herds and specifically the number of people have been infected is likely a huge underestimate. Infected herds in California are seeing mortality rates as high as 15 or 20% compared to 2% in other states, said Keith Polson, a veterinarian and director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, who has researched bird flu. In the state's Central Valley, extreme heat has exacerbated health issues in cows suffering from the virus, which causes fever, slowed milk production, and other symptoms, said Anha Radabaugh, CEO of Western United Dairies, which represents almost 90% of California's dairy farms. Farms that might normally lose one or two cows per month have had hundreds die. Temperatures in the southern Central Valley, home to many dairies, have exceeded 95 degrees Fahrenheit six times so far in October, according to the National Weather Service. So this is the interface, and here California, which is the biggest milk producer, also has some of the highest weather, the hottest weather, big climate change, climate global warming that we've seen. And so if you get sick and you're stuck in hot weather, apparently it increases the death rates massively. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And should that not turn out to be the case, I will gladly triple your money back. Okay, well, that brings us to the last feature of our show here, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 50 bonus articles this week, not quite a record, but pretty darn close. So buckle up. Here we go. Number one, more schools than ever are serving vegan meals in California. Credit environmentally conscious students in a handful of state funding programs. So as you and my regular listeners would know, I am a big fan of whole food plant-based diets, both for their nutritional and health value and for their environmentally conscious way of living. Bonus article two, should we be worried about vegan ultra-processed foods? This is one of those things that if you were, you can have a terrible vegan diet, but if you took just the typical American diet and just took out all the plant-based foods, you'd actually have a pretty crummy diet. It might be worse than having the meat products in there. But of course, when they talk about vegan ultra-processed foods, some of these are like, you know, the fake meats and that kind of stuff. And the short story is that getting rid of the plant, the animal-based foods, actually does improve your health a lot, but the ultra-processed foods that may be vegan are still better than that, but it would be better to use whole, less refined foods. Bonus article three, preoperative nutrition program highly cost-effective in cutting surgery costs and complications. So some of the least healthy people are people that end up in hospitals. And of course, a lot of those folks need surgery. Either they know that going in or it happens while they're in. So having good nutritional status prior to that is very cost effective and can reduce surgery costs and the complications of those surgeries. Bonus article four, a healthy diet can help keep low-grade prostate cancer from progressing to more dangerous states. So a healthy diet is good for preventing cancer in the first place. And if you get early stage cancer, it is actually helpful in preventing the progression to higher grades of cancer. In this case, this particular study is about prostate cancer. Bonus article five, ultra-processed foods worsen blood sugar control in people with type 2 diabetes. compared to whole and minimally processed foods. So, ultra-processed foods are particularly dangerous for people who already have a condition like type 2 diabetes, but they are good for everyone. Bonus Article 6. Protesters demand Kellogg remove artificial colors from Fruit Loops and other cereals. Now, the interesting thing here is that Kellogg actually produces the same products without these artificial colors that they market in other countries, who apparently either regulatorily or consumer-wise have demanded it. So they really just need to switch over the U.S. to those. Of course, that's true with a lot of products. The U.S. formulations from these multinational corporations tend to have more sugar, salt, and in this case, artificial colors. Bonus Article 7, and this is Nutrition 1, that gets back to the basics. Having food at all really helps. Hunger experts say the risk of famine in Gaza remains high. So it abated slightly this summer, but in recent weeks, it has gone full gear, and northern Gaza had only had like two food truck deliveries like in a whole week, and the World Health Organization that's monitoring this closely puts the risk of famine at high. Bonus Article 8, cholera confirmed in Lebanon. WHO declares risk of spread very high. So this is just the expanding conflict, and the bombing and displacement that's happening in Lebanon is raising cholera risk. Cholera is basically from fecal matter in water largely. So when people get displaced and don't have access to clean water and water supplies and waste disposal and stuff is destroyed, that kind of infrastructure, that cholera risk goes way high. True in a lot of conflict zones. Bonus Article 9. Blinken says to Israel, allow more aid into Gaza or face the consequences later. So this is a little bit strange. I mean, this is a terrible story because the U.S. has refused to acknowledge that Israel is blocking humanitarian aid. And part of that political reason, probably the main, if not the only political reason, is that if they determine that Israel is blocking aid, then the U.S. is required by its own law, as well as international law, to stop military aid to that country, in this case, Israel. So, Blinken, if this, in fact, is an admission that Israel is blocking humanitarian aid, the law require that those arms sales and transfers would be stopped, not wait for 30 days, conveniently, past the presidential election in the U.S. You decide what all that means. Bonus Article 10. Wiping out polio will take more time and money, Global Group says. So get going that last mile in eradicating a disease, in this case polio, is sometimes harder than we would hope. And in this case, we've had some setbacks, for instance, in Gaza, where polio has raised its head again. So that's going to be delayed for a little bit of time. Need some more time and some more resources invested. Bonus Article 11, Mpox. Neglect has led to a more dangerous virus now spreading across borders, harming and killing people. Leaders must take action to stop Mpox now. So this is a good article that really just summarizes kind of how we got where we are. And this is a cycle of neglect. You know, we get an attention when it comes around the world to Western nations, but then we immediately, once that abates, lose interest in it, and it just is, for instance, causing even a more dangerous strain to be going around, and almost certainly we'll be seeing that and potentially becoming endemic. The less serious one is endemic in the U.S., meaning it's circulating around just at much lower levels than the outbreak we had earlier. Bonus Article 12, is it time to freak out about bird flu? The answer is not as straightforward as one might like. So I've reported a lot on the bird flu, partly because it's new, and also it's an opportunity to teach about public health, how it works, how it should work, and how it often isn't working that well. The big thing here is a risk communication issue, is that right now, your chance of getting bird flu is very, 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 very low. And unless you're a dairy worker, those people would have a decent chance of getting the bird flu. But the real question for the general population and my listeners here is that if bird flu jumps, if it mutates and jumps to being transmitted easily between human beings, we could go from a very, very low risk to a worldwide pandemic in a matter of days or weeks. Bonus Article 13, new virus uncovered in China. is this a sign tick-borne diseases are on the rise? So this is a new virus that's transmitted by ticks, which is the most common vector for disease in this country. For vector-borne disease, vector meaning like mosquitoes and ticks and that type of thing. So this is another one that may have to do with climate change and the changing of wildlife habitats. Just something to keep an eye out on. And related to that, bonus article 14, mosquitoes that transmit yellow fever and Zika found in Southern California. So the alarms are going up and they're jumping all over this. The mosquitoes that transmit these mosquito-borne diseases have been found in Southern California. And again, as climate change leads to these mosquitoes moving farther north, we're going to see increasing challenges with mosquito-borne diseases. Bonus article 15, WHO says it has certified Egypt as malaria-free. So this is an example where you can actually beat back these mosquito-borne diseases, primarily by getting at the mosquitoes themselves, but also, for instance, a big difference between, like, say, the U.S. and many, quote, third world countries would be even just adequate housing where you have screens or netting to protect you from mosquito bites. There's a lot of things you can do, and congratulations, Egypt, you're the 44th country to be certified malaria-free by the WHO. Bonus article 16, new nasal vaccines offer better protection from COVID and flu, and no needle is needed. So I've reported on this before, these nasal vaccines will offer immunity right at the point of initial infection and may actually prevent infection rather than just reduce the severity of disease. And the nice thing about this, it's easier to administer. And for those people that have needle phobias, which I reported on before, is actually quite high, no needle is actually needed. Good progress. Hope to see that make the market sooner than later. Bonus article 17. In children, COVID is tied to higher risk of type 2 diabetes. I've reported on this before, and just more evidence showing that the after effects of COVID can lead to other health problems. Bonus article 18. USDA watchdog opening investigation into agency handling of Boar's Head deadly food poisoning outbreak as imminent threat citations were ignored. So this killed, I think, nine or 11 people, killed a number of people with this food poisoning outbreak. And a couple years ago, the USDA, in its own in investigations and inspections, declared an imminent threat there. But that fact was ignored over and over again, so it's being investigated. Bonus article 19, this is a Halloween story, I suppose. Flesh-eating bacteria cases rise in Florida after hurricanes Helene and Milton. So this is something that they experienced at a low level before, but it looks like it's probably going to double the number of flesh-eating bacteria cases just because the contaminated waters, flood waters from the hurricane, can put people in contact with the flesh-eating bacteria. And if you have open wounds or not, yes, it can be very dangerous. Unfortunately, this is actually like 1 in 5 chance of killing you. Not nice. Bonus article 20. Helene and CVS land double whammy for 25,000 patients who survive on IV nutrition. So this is because it knocked out that plant that produced these IV solutions, in this case, nutritional IV solutions. And you're finding that even like in Massachusetts, way outside the range of the hurricane, because the supply of this IV nutrition solution, that people are being trapped in hospitals because CVS doesn't have access to any more supply and they can't leave the hospital. Hospitals are probably prioritized for getting what is available. But of course, that isn't good for the person. It isn't good for the hospital. But that's just another example of how hurricanes can affect our health, even outside of the immediate path. Bonus article 21. As IV shortage continues after hurricane, U.S. invokes wartime power to speed recovery by prioritizing rebuilding. So these war powers are actually being invoked to try to prioritize getting contractors to rebuild that factory. Bonus article 22. FEMA told victims of New Mexico's largest wildfire it can't pay for emotional harm. A judge will likely rule it must. This could increase equitability of relief. So this is an interesting development because a lot of lower income people don't really have much property of value. So when they get hit and wiped out and, you know, lose their apartment building and have to move and stuff, They only may get relief for what little, you know, net value, what property that they have. But if you were to include the stress and emotional harm that happens by dislocation, this would actually even out the amount of relief that would disproportionately help those of lower income. So it might increase equity. Bonus Article 23, climate change can make addiction recovery more difficult. Very similar to that previous story, the stress and harms of dislocation that are brought about by natural climate disasters, or maybe not so natural, but climate disasters anyways, it can make addiction recovery more difficult by making all of life more difficult, thus making addiction more difficult. Bonus Article 24. Forests are burning at unprecedented levels, releasing massive amounts of carbon, globally 60% more than in 2001. The world is on fire. Bonus Article 25. White House cements clean construction deals with some states and industry. So this is a move of these kind of voluntary deals with some states in New York City and some industry to try to use construction materials like cement and steel that actually has less carbon emissions and environmental impact. And this could be an important leader in kind of the industry to set new, more environmentally friendly standards. Good news. Bonus Article 26. The U.S. designates a new marine sanctuary led by indigenous people, which is a first. Hey, like I've said many times before, I'll say again, if the world is going to be saved and made sustainable in the long run, we will have to thank indigenous people for leading the way. Bonus Article 27. Living under this constant threat, environmental defenders face a mounting mental health crisis. And around the world, many of those environmental defenders are, in fact, indigenous people. We should take care of the planet and those defending it. Thank you. Bonus Article 28. The health benefits of spending time in nature. This is a nice little summary of the fact that our brains are really geared towards being outdoors. Bonus Article 29. Another Halloween story. Halloween costumes may pose hidden chemical risks. This is probably a good example of, or worst example of, like fast fashion, you know, single-use costumes that are polluted with, you know, lead or chemicals, other toxic substances. Yikes. Bonus Article 30. What are we made of? Blood, guts, and plastic. Moving towards natural alternatives to safeguard human health and environment. So this is a good little summary of the complications of all the plastic and the chemicals that come with it, and the fact that there are places and examples where you can move towards natural alternatives to protect both people and the environment. Bonus Article 31, U.S. Supreme Court to hear case on disputed West Texas high-level nuclear waste storage plant at, quote, interim facility. So the company that's actually doing this is like Interim Storage Partners or something like that. So high-level nuclear waste needs to be stored permanently, meaning tens and tens of thousands of years. You can't just put it in interim temporary thing. So this is the problem, the fundamental problem with nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, nuclear weapon production. Bonus Article 32, health effects of chemical mixtures. Neurotoxic effects add up, new study shows. This is a very elegant study that actually looked at the combination of chemicals present in people's blood and then tested those for their neurotoxic effects and created some mixtures based on what they found actually in people's blood. And it basically shows that you could have a bunch of chemicals that are below levels that are considered toxic, so in the so-called safe range, but when you test those chemicals all together, they basically add up and become dangerous. So that's just and points out the danger of most of our ways we determine the toxicity of a chemical is just looking at one chemical at a time, when in real life we're exposed to hundreds, if not thousands, of toxic chemicals. Bonus Article 33, study finds widespread exposure to hormone-disrupting chemical during pregnancy. So, of course, pregnancy is a very vulnerable time for hormone disruption, and many of these chemicals are hormone disruptors. Bonus Article 34, sticking to the pregnancy theme, spike in emergency visits for life-threatening pregnancy complication of hypertension. So, in recent years, we've seen hypertension increasing emergency room visits, which basically means it isn't being treated well and people are having to go to the emergency room for the first treatment of it. Bonus article 35. 11 experts on why gains in our number one killer, cardiovascular disease, are stalling and what we can do about it. So, unfortunately, heart disease, the number one killer, we've made a lot of progress in recent generations, but that has stalled and we're even seeing reversals. Bonus article 36. Failure to rescue. Study suggests why women die more than men after cardiovascular surgery. So women are no more likely to have complications after cardiovascular surgery, but they're more likely to die of those complications, partly because it's a failure to rescue. There just isn't as aggressive identification and treatment for those complications. Bonus article 37. High blood pressure reduces respiratory capacity due to the hardening of bronchi. That's all those little trees in there. And of course, you would expect that your cardiovascular system, the vascular part of it, is all through your body. It's why, you know, it affects our heart, but it also, you know, affects our circulation in general. It affects our brain, you know, like with strokes, and affects our lungs, which is very vascularized because it's where we transfuse oxygen from the air and carbon dioxide out into the air. You need a lot of blood in order to do that, and a lot of small blood vessels that can be clogged up by cardiovascular disease. Bonus article 38. Are dental practices out of control in the United States? This is a little bit of kind of my pet peeves. You know, dental has been handled very differently. You know, it's got its own insurance. It kind of operates alone, kind of outside the rest of the healthcare system. And this is, I'd recommend, this would be one of the few that I really recommend that you actually take a look at, particularly if you're at all skeptical about dentistry, because a lot of it is driven around the business profit part of it and not necessarily evidence-based science of health, what's good for you, the patient. Bonus article 39. Want electronic reimbursement? That will cost you a $5 fee. Predatory insurance fees underscore need for physician payment reform. So this is a great way, the money changers, just to grab, just like an unqualified tax, basically saying, you know, what electronic reimbursement is actually easier and cheaper to do. They just charge you a fee, 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%. Just take money right off the top for doing what would be the easiest for all concerned anyways. Ridiculous. That is price gouging. Bonus article 40. How chronic shortages of a childhood cancer drug makes the unimaginable worse. So these are relatively inexpensive drugs, but also they are not that expensive to make, so you can't make that much money. So pharmaceutical companies aren't really interested. They're interested in focusing on things that make a lot more money. Wouldn't it be nice just to have a job that treats childhood cancer? Would that be good enough at a decent wage? Come on, people. We can do better. Bonus article 41. Doctors, not AI, should authorize treatments. A new California law shows the way. Way to go, California, showing us the way. And of course, doctors, a human healthcare involvement in AI should be the authorization of treatments, not just having an algorithm doing it without human input and approval. Bonus article 42. 23andMe faces an uncertain future. Here's how to delete your DNA data. And actually, it shows you ways you can adjust how that in the privacy policy and stuff, how it's used. So if you have your DNA data at 23andMe, might be a good article to read. Bonus article 43. Few hospital websites post about LGBTQ plus services or policies. You would think with the millions and millions of LGBTQ persons in this country who require health services that hospitals would actually provide information that would be helpful to them, but they're not meeting that need very well. Bonus article 44. Crisis pregnancy centers forms give rare insight into anti-abortion practices, promising to protect sensitive health data, but they aren't bound by federal privacy law. So they just collect a crazy amount of personal information that's not needed for health. It's just trying to counsel you to not have an abortion. And unfortunately, that sensitive information is not protected by federal privacy law. Bonus article 45. Some docs are ignoring the wishes of breast cancer survivors who opt out of breast reconstruction. Can you imagine saying you don't want breast reconstruction, coming out of surgery and finding that they have done breast reconstruction against your explicit demands? This is ridiculous. Listen to women. Bonus article 46. With 20,000 plus brain injured each year, the U.S. military tests how to partially protect troops from blasts. So they're trying to test explosives that are directed more at the enemy than at the troops themselves. Seems like a genius idea. I would say I would like to cash in that peace dividend and say, let's not have people blowing each other up and then try to bring health out of that. Yikes, kind of a weird kind of a conundrum or paradox or something. Bonus article 47, make America healthy again. RFK Jr.'s plan sounds catchy, but won't move the national needle. This is from one of my favorites, my local epidemiologist, and it's a good overview, basically saying that when you're mixing a lot of completely crazy, unsound science with some good science and some halfway decent ideas, it's just confusing. And these policies as a whole don't really get at the heart of what their nation's health challenges are. Bonus article 48, the problem that's even bigger than healthcare, declining trust in governments worldwide. So this is a global phenomenon, and it's a threat to public health. Bonus article 49, Norway's early childhood education law decrees, let childhood be childhood. So Norway doesn't look at childcare as just a way to warehouse your kids while you're at work. They really look at thriving children and teaching about diversity and acceptance and just have, you know, a free-range childhood in a safe environment. Very different than what is happening in other places of the world, particularly the U.S. Bonus article 50, last but not least, people regularly experiencing brighter nights and darker days have higher mortality risks. This goes back to the sinking of light and dark in our lives. And if you're getting light interfering with your night and you're having darker days, that increases your chance of dying. You can read these and all the other articles I reported on in this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.